New students to a school district must now disclose if they've had mental health counseling. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It's a provision in the new safety laws that were created in the wake of the Parkland shooting. But this law has some parents confused and concerned as to what information they have to share with educators. We'll dive into the law and how it could be problematic for school districts. Plus, a new show looks at life through the eyes of Latinas in South Florida. 24 of them. We'll meet the woman who is portraying all of those characters, the star of a one-woman show, Huacata, or A Latina's Guide to Surviving the Universe. And there's an 8-week class devoted to teaching women how to be DJs. We'll meet the teacher and one of her students to get an inside look at the world that's been dominated by men. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. A controversial new Florida law requires parents of children new to a school district to disclose whether they've received mental health counseling. This law was part of a number of school safety measures passed in the wake of the Parkland shooting. The required disclosure is raising concerns among parents who aren't clear what qualifies as mental health counseling and whether the school districts share that information with future employers or law enforcement. Joining us to discuss is Julio Ochoa, editor for Health News Florida. He's at the studios of WUSF in Tampa, and Elisa LaPolte, executive director for the Florida Division of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, who's joining us by Skype. They also have insights on the new funding that was allocated for mental health services in Florida schools for this upcoming year. Elisa, Julio, such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you.
Julio, let me start with you. Let's break down what this provision of the law entails when it says a family must disclose if a child has had mental health counseling. What exactly are they asking for?
That's a good question, Luis. It's basically the districts are saying, are pointing to the law. The state is pointing to the law. They say the language in the law is what we're asking school districts for. And that language states requires students to disclose mental health referrals at registration. So that's what they're going off of, and that's what they're asking parents to do.
Is there a certain period of time for treatment of certain mental illnesses? I mean, do they want to know, you know, specifics? Or, is it just general that you've had some kind of treatment recently?
Right. Just a referral is all they're asking. They don't say, you know, what if it's, you know, ADHD or if it's another mental health illness. And so that's creating a lot of questions among parents, right? Because they want to know what they're supposed to say on this question, how they're supposed to answer this question. One thing I've heard from districts is there is no penalty for not answering the question. So it really has no teeth if you don't answer.
Well, that's new to me. Actually, I did not know that. Elisa, what types of calls have you been getting from parents? What are people asking about?
Yeah, so we've gotten a few calls, and the biggest thing that they're concerned about is how this information is going to be shared, because we do have what's called FERPA, which is the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, and student records with regard to education are private. Under certain situations, the information can be shared, and that's what concerns parents, because at the end of the day, unfortunately, there still is a stigma about seeking help and treatment for mental health services. And parents are concerned that that information might get leaked out to teachers and other students and exacerbating the stigma.
How are you advising parents? What are you telling them?
So we're in a new territory here. We have this situation where we've got HIPAA, laws that protect medical privacy, and then we've got FERPA, as I just mentioned. We're just advising parents to ask questions. Ask their school districts, how is this information going to be shared? How will the information be protected?
And have you seen a law like this, a provision like this, anywhere else in the country?
You know, it's funny. I just had a conversation just this morning with our national office, the NAMI office in Arlington, and certainly there's concern there. We're not aware of any other laws like this.
Julio, you've spoken with a couple of different school districts in the Tampa area. So how are they responding? How are they preparing for this?
Well, since it's up to each individual school district to come up with a plan for how to respond to this or how to deal with this, it can be all over the map. For example, when I asked who will have access to this information, I asked a few different school districts that. One district told me that it will be seen by the front desk staff who have classified information training, as well as student services staff, which are like counselors and social workers and psychologists. Another district said it will go into the students' records, which are visible to their teachers, school administrators, and those same student service employees, and some administrators, or district administrators as well. So at the school district level, they'll actually be able to see this. So depending on the school district you ask, it can go to different people can have access to this information. So it's kind of up to each individual school district to come up with a plan. And some of them, as of this week, were still taking their plans to their school boards and discussing those plans and having the public comment on those plans.
Now, as you said, they're basically leaving it up to the individual school districts to handle this. But have you spoken to anybody with the Florida Department of Education? I'm wondering what their response is to all of this.
Yeah, I asked them for a response, and they kind of put out a canned statement that they've been giving to the media, which says, the Department of Education says the decisions on how parents report their child's mental health services are up to each school district. So they say they don't have the authority to provide guidance, and they encourage the districts to work with their school board attorneys for coming up with a plan on implementing this.
Alisa, what more do you need to know for you to gather information, I should say? What more is it you're trying to understand in order to help parents? Because you're going to get more calls.
Oh, absolutely. So I am the executive director of the state office, and we've got 26 chapters, which we call affiliates, across the state. We're actually going to be having a conference call here shortly because I want to hear from our 26 affiliates, what are they hearing out in the field from parents? So right now we're in an information gathering stage because we want to be able to, you know, have parents feel comfortable about sharing this information because there shouldn't be a stigma around their children getting mental health services.
I'm speaking with Health News Florida editor Julio Ochoa and Alisa Lapolt, executive director of NAMI Florida. We've been going over the details of a new Florida law that requires that parents of students new to a school district, they should disclose whether they've received mental health counseling. We're also discussing new funding for Florida school districts to provide mental health funding as well. But it's still interesting, though, Julio, as you said, that that if parents don't want to, they don't even have to tell the school district. So the school district has no teeth. They can't push back.
That's what I've heard from a few school districts. I mean, it may be different in different areas, but the ones I told I heard from said they do not have any enforcement of this. So, I mean, there's no penalty is what they told me, actually, for not disclosing mental health referrals.
And how would a school district verify, by the way, whatever you tell them?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, as Alisa said, this is a HIPAA violation. You know, if you go to a doctor and ask whether this child has been treated for mental health issues.
Have you talked to any school administrators about this issue that if the parent decides they don't want to answer, that what are they going to do?
I mean, I asked that to the school districts that I sent out a form asking them questions, and they just said there's no penalty. I said, is there a penalty for not reporting this? And they said no.
Alisa, your organization was critical in the lobbying efforts that got this legislation passed, allocating $104 million for mental health services in schools. What could that level of funding provide for the millions of students across the state of Florida? What do you envision?
Well, the money was broken down in several areas. For instance, there's $9.8 million for more community action treatment teams across the state, $18.3 million for mobile crisis units. And the big piece that we were looking at, well, actually, there were two pieces. One is mental health awareness and assistance training. That was $6.7 million. That's going to go towards teaching school personnel, teachers, and so forth, how to recognize the signs and symptoms of mental illness and how students can get help. And that's where we were instrumental in getting some language in. And then another piece is the $69 million for mental health assistance. School districts are actually being required to put together plans on how they will interface with the community in getting students the help that they need in terms of, you know, mental health services. So, you know, if you talk to the principals, the superintendents, the school districts, they're saying that that $69 million isn't going to go far amongst, you know, 67 school districts.
You know, Julio, but Elisa, you can also jump in on this, is that some of the items that I understand are allocated for this new funding include mobile crisis units and community action teams. Do we know exactly what these terms mean and how they operate?
Yeah, right. They're kind of hard to understand, I guess. And it doesn't say a whole lot about them in the law, but it sounds like these teams are there to help out in counties that don't have as many resources as maybe Miami-Dade has. So, you know, school districts have a limited number of school psychologists on staff. Some have to be split between, you know, two or three schools. So in especially in rural districts, they just don't have the resources. So maybe these teams will come together. The state will put together these teams. I think they allocated like $12.8 million for the community action treatment teams. So maybe a team that can go around to school districts that don't have resources and help out in those areas. I think that's my understanding of it anyway.
Elisa, I don't know if you wanted to chime in on that.
Sure. So these community action treatment teams are already in place in several locations around the state. What we did see from the legislature this year is an increase in funding for the so-called CAT teams. These community action treatment teams are the ones that provide intensive treatment for individuals with mental illness. So that's going to be helpful for those students who are exhibiting you know, signs and symptoms of mental illness. And then with the mobile crisis units, there's actually some very effective crisis units in place in South Florida. And, you know, certainly that's a situation where like a mobile crisis team can come to a school if there is a threat or a risk underway. And that would be very, very helpful. And I think the legislature recognized the role that these mobile crisis units can play in these, you know, school tragedies.
Elisa, you know, this is a new law. It's a new provision also within that new law. And so we've seen school districts, they're scrambling to meet the law, to make sure that they are in compliance. What's a concern you may have? As you know, school's about to start soon, and some of these schools may not be ready.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we're in new territory. You know, I know that the legislature wanted to respond very quickly to the Parkland tragedy, and rightfully so. I think what we're going to see in the 2019 legislative session is a glitch bill, probably providing a little more guidance on some of these gray areas. My concern is that there are areas of this law that are too broad, that are open to interpretation in a way that's going to continue to promote the stigma against students who seek mental health services. And it's important to recognize that not everybody who seeks services for mental illness or mental health challenge is a danger to the safety of other students. You know, they could get help for the loss of a parent, a breakup of a boyfriend. So it's just really important to remember that people who seek help for mental illness and mental health challenges are not dangerous.
And Julio, what else are you finding in the reporting on this issue? Again, a school is about to start. What are we missing?
Well, I mean, the plans are due today, actually, from school districts to the state for how they are going to implement the mental health aspect into their schools. So we're going to start to see school districts filing these plans, and we're going to start to see some of this information come out about how they're going to use this money and how they're going to implement these mental health plans. So I think in the coming weeks, we're going to get a better idea of what this funding will mean to students. You know, I mean, at the heart of it, it's there to help kids through a difficult time in their life, right? And this can be a great thing for kids to actually get the mental health services that they need when they need them. So hopefully it can be used in that way. You know, I agree with Elisa about the stigma, you know, and there must be a privacy issue here so that students who get this treatment aren't exposed to the rest of the school or you know, dealt with in a private manner.
Julio Cho is the editor for Health News Florida. He is joining us from the studios of WUSF in Tampa. We also spoke with Elisa LaPolte, executive director for the Florida Division of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. She joined us by Skype. Elisa, thank you so much for your time. Julio, always appreciate it.
Thanks, Luis.
Thanks for this opportunity.
All right, still to come on the program, we're going to meet the performer of a one-woman show that has 24 characters. She might even introduce us to some of them. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thanks again for joining us. So what does it mean to be Latina in South Florida? If you're from South America, Central America, Cuba, Puerto Rico, or Mexico, this one-woman performance highlights the multi-layers of Latina women in Miami by showing the many roles that women play and their resiliency in their daily life. The performance is called Fuacata, or
Yay.
Latina's Guide to Surviving the Universe. I knew I was going to get that right. It is back in Miami by popular demand. It stars more than 20 Latinas, all played by Elena Maria Garcia, the Cuban-American artist based the characters on her life experiences while growing up in South Florida. And the show centers around the themes of love, marriage, immigration, identity, so many things. Again, it follows the story of a Latina's busy workday and how she deals with the many fuacatas or unfortunate events during a normal day in Miami. Joining us in studio is Elena Maria Garcia. She hopes the performance will inspire Latinos to get their act together. Hopefully, maybe. We'll see. Elena, such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. I cannot believe this.
All right. First of all, just explain. And I've been practicing. I really have. Fuacata. What is that?
Fuacata is a figurative backhanded slap that will unhinge your jaw. And kind of wakes you up,
yeah. Especially the way you say it. I don't put the emphasis on it that you do.
Yeah, it depends where you are. You know, parents. You know, they look at you and go, "Fuacata." You know, it just depends. It depends on the level, how far back they will pull that hand. Yeah.
Any Latinos in there with Latino parents? We know. 24 characters.
Yeah, 24.
How'd you decide on that many?
We didn't decide on 24. We just started writing it. Stuart Meltzer, the artistic director of Zoetic Stage, along with myself, we just started with the character of Elena and her battle of trying to get café. And then as we kept writing, these characters would show up. And there were other characters that showed up, but we cut them out.
And who are these women exactly? I mean, are these real people that you've known?
Yes. For example, the character of Marisol, I've always, when I'm in Miami and I see these people on the median selling water or oranges, etc., I've always wondered what their story is like. And so we researched and found this one character, this one woman, Marisol, and her journey through human smuggling and all of that stuff and how she got here. And so we kind of developed her, that character. Mommy is mommy. Everybody has the mommy. It you have no idea. I think it after they go over the 60-65 hump, they all go into that one mold.
Right.
Yeah. And so mommy is my mom.
Is there one character that you, I guess, resonates most with you?
Wow. That resonates. Yes. Graciela.
Who is Graciela?
Graciela is a performance artist. And her performance is not the best in the world, but she gives it her all. And that character is actually based on my cat. I know. I would love to say, wow, you know, I went. No, no. And because I would talk through my cat, I know people, anyone that has animals, we usually put words to them sometimes, you know, we speak for them. And then I would speak for my cat. And then Graciela showed up and I was like, oh, I want to do her.
Can we meet Graciela?
Ay, pues Graciela, pues sí. I would like to let everybody know there is so much love in this room right now in NPR. I love NPR. I love NPR. I love the journalists. They have so much love in their soul and they want to give it to everyone. They are the right news, my friend. Yes, NPR. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. El amor, el amor, el amor.
So I'm watching, you know what I'm watching as you're doing this. Uh-huh. And I always find fascinating with performers is how they get into character.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's got their thing, whatever it is. Some people need a moment and other people can do it right away. You just jumped right in. But how do you do that? Because you've got 24, 25 of these things,
yeah,
characters. So what's your technique?
It's physically. I just have to find through a lot of rehearsal and trying to find these characters physically and go from one to the other and be able to the detail in them, and I live them. I live them when I speak like them. My body automatically goes into that, and it's something I've done my whole life. I used to get in a lot of trouble, you know, making, copying people, etc. And now it's paying off, kids.
So it's body movement,
body, voice, the center of energy, you know, wherever that character is, and staying there, and then, you know, like, you know, doing Graciela. I can't do Graciela without being Graciela.
What is the Latina experience in South Florida, in Miami specifically?
It's the hustle. It's the getting up, always being at your top game, and you have to hit everything at 100%. And if you don't, you know, there's that sense of you're not doing your best, but yet we are. And I am also, I mean, there's the Miami, you know, the Miami Latina, but I'm also, I'm a Broward Cuban.
There's a difference.
Huge difference. But yeah, it's still, I mean, a mom, a working mother today is just an Olympic feat. It really is.
You know what? You say today, but I think always. I could say, yeah, watching my mom, what she was doing growing up. Mm-hmm. You grew up in Broward County.
Yes.
What? Tell us about those differences. What was it like for you as you're growing up?
Well, growing up in Broward, I was truly a minority. We were one of the few Cuban families or Hispanic families in Plantation. And a huge amount of discrimination and you know, bullying and threats and the whole shebang, all through school, until finally in high school, my Latin sisters were there, Madonna Academy, yay. And we were all of a sudden, there were other Hispanic names, you know, Rosa Aleman, Dalia Sanchez. I'm like, what? I'm not the only Garcia in here? And then it was like, we have to band together. And we did. It was then it was a family.
But as you were growing up, did you have to hide? Did you try to hide your ethnicity?
No. That's why I got beat up.
Because you wanted, you're Garcia.
Garcia, Elena. Not Elaine, Alana, Alina, Mary, Marsha. Those were all of my fun names that they called me. Instead of Elena. I would say Elena Garcia, and they would go, oh, you Mexican? You speak Mexican, right? That was, yeah. Well, that was in Davie.
Was that, how much did that kind of play into, you know, that desire to want to perform? I mean, I don't know if that was that an escape for you? Did it help you in any way?
No. I've always wanted to perform since I was 5, when I saw Shirley Temple in The Little Princess.
That's where it all started.
Yeah, when I showed my mom that's what I wanted to do, and she told me, shut the hell up. You're not going to be that. No, in Cuba, ay Dios mío, una prostituta. You know, that's what I would end up being. Well, but that generation, that's how they saw, you know, an actor or someone in the arts. But now she's my number one fan.
When did that change, though?
When they saw me in college on stage. And they were like, eh, meh, yeah. She can do it.
That's what
that's
they,
fine.
They finally bought into it.
They were like, all right, like, we got to stop fighting this.
I'm talking with Cuban American actress Elena Maria Garcia. I'm going to get this right.
Don't say Marsha.
Nope. She's starring in a one-woman show called Fuacata.
Yes!
Fuacata, Latina's Guide to Surviving the Universe. She's performing more than 20 different characters. By the way, it's at the Adrian Arts Center, and it starts tonight.
It's right? A preview. It's, preview it tonight. Opens tomorrow, but preview tonight.
A preview tonight.
Yeah.
I wanted to come back to, you know, when you wanted to start acting, and that I think that's an interesting story. Really the immigrant story,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, you tend to hear the story of immigrants. They come to this country, and they want their kids, get the education, and then to have a great career.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd imagine that's kind of, that was pushed on you. They wanted you to be what? What did your parents want you to do?
They knew I was no good in math. And my father said, listen, you're so into, you know, your health. Why don't you become a dietitian? I said, I would kill my first patient. I can't do that. Because my father, may he rest in peace, he would always say, I can give you anything and anyone can take it away from you. But one thing I can give you that no one can take away is your education. So when he saw me on stage, that's when he said, that's it. I need to be quiet. This is what she wants to do. And from that moment on, they realized, you know what? Everyone has a gift. And if you don't feed that gift, it goes away. So feed the gift. And they went ahead and they supported me. And I'm, you know, I do what I do today because of their support. Now, truly, before that, there was intervention, just like they have drug intervention, they had career intervention. And they would bring family and friends in pretending like they were visiting me, but they weren't. And then I'd be like, oh my God, how are you? And I'm like, oh no, not another one. And they sit down, Elena, you can't do this to the family. You don't understand. You could be so many other things. I an actress. Yeah. And then again, now it's like, ay, Elena. Oh, yes, she's fantastic. Es Elena. Ay, Dios mío. Yeah, now everything changed.
By the way, how many of your characters have any of your family up there on the stage? Or do they think that they're seeing themselves up there on the stage?
My mother, one of my daughters, I've got two daughters, Anna and Emma, and I kind of put them in one character. I've got my family, the story that the mommy does about the Ida and Pancho, that those are my parents, and how in the park in Santi Espiritu where they grew up, how they would walk around the park, and my mother always wanted my father to notice her, and there, and the flan that the recipe is the actual recipe my mother makes, which by the way, it's the best flan you'll ever have anyway. And so yeah, there's bits and pieces, my family name Candelaria, and yeah, so I sprinkled it a little bit. And Mr. Stuart Meltzer was amazing with that. He said, absolutely.
And you've got your cat in there, too. So
yes, Pablo el Diablo.
Something else that's interesting is at one point in the program, in the show, you have four characters going at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So now how is it for you? Is it something you're trying to show the audience, a separation? Or what is it you're doing in that scene?
There's usually It's a high energy. It's Elena coming in, and then the head teacher, Ms. Puig, and the excited intern, and it's that scene. So it's just simple shifts, but you can tell that it's a scene. It's a scene. It's any Latin family when telling a story does all the characters at one shot. And they explain it, and you follow along. You know exactly what they're talking about. I mean, I was in rehearsal since I was five. Okay? Watching my mother doing everybody at the same time and changing her voice and her mannerisms and all of that. Yeah, so that's normal for us. To hear someone just tell a story, you're like, oh, where's the color? And then I remember going to University of Florida. Again, the only Cuban in my department. And I was told, wow, y'all so expressive. Please don't use your hands. And I'm like, what? But I'm like, that's how we talk. No, no one talks like that. I won't come down south. That's how we all talk.
I mean, there's humor, but you do touch on some pretty hardcore issues.
Yes, we do. Absolutely.
So, I mean, is it, you know, do you care when people are laughing, or is it, no, we're going to talk about something important now? Or for you, what does it mean as you're performing on stage when you're changing topics and issues?
When I go from it's a relatively funny scene, and we move into Marisol, the girl from Honduras, the audience is still in that laugh mode, and then when they realize, I literally feel the audience sit back and go, "What happened? I thought this was a comedy," but they get it. They get it, and I have to have them in the palm of my hand at the very beginning, and then I hold them. I go, "Don't worry, buddy. Just trust me. We're going to go through little bumps, but you need the bumps." And we have not. It's not heavy handed like that. It's enough for you to go, "Ho ho ho ho, clever. That was good." So we do. We bring in our Mexican American, and she talks about compassion. And we talk the girl from Honduras, Marisol, and she talks about just being free. That as Americans, we take that like, and what she goes through, and still she's so thankful. The fake news.
Tell me about it.
Oh, it's just small.
Tell me about it.
It's just a one-liner, and I always get, oh, from the audience. I'm like, that's right. But it's the character that says it. It's Beatrice Goldberg, and she says it, so it's okay.
I'm just going to bug you. I want to hear the line now.
Oh, the line
yes.
is? Well, I can't, am I allowed to, I can't cuss.
Oh, no, that's okay then.
I can't.
If you can't, then don't.
No.
That's okay. You know what? Something about you that I'd read was that I thought was interesting is here we are in South Florida and we have this, you know, this big mix of really every kind of Latino,
mm-hmm.
you know, and what's always interesting, and you've run into this a lot, is, well, people who don't know may think, oh, a Latino's a Latino. And yet, you know, that I'm half Puerto Rican, half Colombian. Those are two very different people.
Very.
And a Mexican is different from a Guatemalan, from a Peruvian.
Yes.
Everybody's very different.
Very much.
But how do you think we see our differences? I mean, you know, I want your take on how Latinos see Latinos.
We come together when there is an adversary, when there's someone that is against. Okay, and then we all come together, but then we're against each other. You know, you can't, don't mix a Mexican with a Cuban. Those are fighting words. I'm like, why? I don't get it. I understand that we are absolutely different countries, cultures, etc. But if we could just come together and really work, I mean, we would be such a powerful force. We really would, especially now with everything that is happening, all of these children. I mean, I marched over there in Homestead and still had some Latin saying, nah, they chose to be there. I'm like, I'm going to go to prison. I'm like, what? How come it was okay for when you came during the Castro regime and this country had their arms open, but now it's not okay? How did that, what's the difference between your freedom and their freedom?
Do you think that things are changing? Do you think that Latinos are coming together in some way? And it's not just what's happening in this country, but think about what's going on in a lot of these other countries. I mean, think about what's happening in Venezuela. Mm. Think about all these different, are Latinos maybe coming together or no?
No. I don't think, I think there's so much more work to that. I think what's happening in Venezuela just breaks my heart. It is horrible. I had a friend of mine that just came and she says, Elena, you can't even imagine. And to know that it's, you know, bueno, that's them. No, it's not them. I think as a community, we could be so much stronger. Our communication could be much clearer. We could do so much for each other. And we and even with the children right now that are in all these detention centers, there's more to this. And also the politicians say, you know.
So how does your show bring all of this together, bring all of these groups together?
Elena finds herself fighting, or kind of not fighting, but trying to teach her daughter that there's a difference between the two flags, the Puerto Rican flag and the Cuban flag. And in the end, she has a cathartic moment of realizing, no, we're all together here. And one of the characters, Lulu, kind of says to her, Elena Flores, come on now. Why are we all fighting over whose flag is what? We need to all come together and join forces. You know what I mean?
Wait a minute. What is that? A little New Yorker there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Oh. Oh. Yes. Lulu. She's done some time. Yeah. But for the right reasons. Okay. For the right reasons.
Is there one character that was the hardest to bring out?
Puig, I think Ms. Puig, she was part of Operation Pedro Pan. And she comes to this country, she brings her mother here, but she never marries because she becomes the typical, you know, I'm here to take care of my mom. And she stays and takes care of her mom. But her whole thing is looking at parenting in the United States, parenting, how it's all a competition. And yet all she wanted was her parents to be with her. And she doesn't, her father never comes over.
Anyone who's never seen a one woman, one person show, these are amazing. These are, when they're, it really is flabbergasting when you're sitting there and you see one person give you this wide range of a community. If they do it right, you really, you think you've met that many people. What do you tell people to expect, you know, how to approach a show like this if they've never seen one?
Use your imagination. Just allow it. I mean, there's no costume changes. There's nothing. It's just me. And it's storytelling. It really is storytelling from beginning to end, and just get on the ride and just allow yourself and be open to it. That's it.
Well, I could say this. I mean, just from watching you and the few characters you've done, there's no costume change. You completely changed and you became another person. I was watching you do that. That's hilarious. Again, the preview is tonight.
Yes.
And it starts tomorrow. It's at the
yes.
Adrian Arch Center.
Yes.
Again, Elena Maria Garcia. It is called Fuacata.
Yes.
Gosh, I got it. Thank you. Latina's Guide to Surviving the Universe. And you know what? We're going to do a Facebook Live right after the program. So you're going to give us a little bit more of a taste. All right. So
can I give a shout out to my New World kids, my Universal Acting, and my Nova Southeastern University students?
Yay! All right. Perfect. Elena, thank you so much. I appreciate
it. Thank you, NPR. You rock.
All right. Still to come. What's it like being a DJ? What's it like being a DJ when you're a woman? That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, Miami is well known for its dance music scene, from festivals like Ultra to the clubs in South Beach partying almost every night. But how often are women the ones DJing at those events? 15 women are part of a new 8-week DJing class called Girls Can Spin 2, focused on increasing gender parity in the profession. And you're hearing one of their tracks now. The class is a collaboration between a Miami sisterhood collective empowering women of color called FemPower and Art Cortex, an art school DJing program for kids. Now, both organizations recognize the lack of women in the DJing industry. Joined forces, they launched this course. Students who took the class learned to cue songs, mix tunes, but most importantly, they built confidence. Christina Hernandez is a teacher and a DJ at Girls Can Spin 2. Christina, pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited.
Also joining us, one of the students actually in the class is Monica Sorrell, and I believe the graduation graduation party is coming up, what, tomorrow?
Yes, tomorrow.
Monica, by the way, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know what, Christina, let me ask you this. First of all, how'd you get into DJing? When did it start for you?
For me, it started about 10 years ago. It all came from just a passion for music, wanting to play my music, things I weren't listening to when I was going out or to, you know, bars or clubs. So I took it upon myself to teach myself. And
wait, you taught yourself?
Yeah, I taught myself.
I mean, there's no place to go to learn this?
Years ago? No way.
Wow.
It was even odd for me to mention the fact that I was, you know, leaning towards becoming a DJ. It was very surprising for people.
And you know what? I mean, look, it's I got to tell you that before I was here, I was living in Las Vegas. I got the chance to talk to a lot of DJs. But I realized very quickly, it's like, wait a second, this is all guys. It's a man's world still?
Yeah, it's a very male-dominated scene, but I'm happy to say that now, 2018, there's so many female DJs, and they're working it, they're doing it.
As you were coming up, what were some of the challenges that you ran into? You know, what kind of things did you hear from people? I wanted to get a sense of what it was like for you to try to break into the business.
I think you just constantly have to prove yourself, especially to people that, you know, have been in the music industry for very long. Music education and knowledge is very important. So just knowing your stuff, really, and having to continuously prove yourself, and even going into certain bars or clubs, trying to bring myself to DJ at these places. There was a lot of no's, but when they heard your music, they're like, okay, let's give it a shot.
Were there any female DJs that you did look up to that you thought, well, you know, they were, I guess, really setting the bar?
More like producers, to be honest. Like Toki Monsta was one of my favorite producers. Is still. So DJing is kind of the gateway for music production, which is my next step.
And there is a difference between what being a music producer and
DJing. Absolutely. Music production, you're creating from nothing. You're creating music. DJing is mixing and just playing your favorite tracks and trying to bring them together.
Monica, what got you into this? How did this all start for you?
I think I didn't realize it, but I have always had an interest in DJing. I think it's just something that never felt accessible to me. And then about a year ago, actually, there's this event called Vinyl Social Club in North Miami, where you know, I kind of challenged myself to just go up there and play a set for 20 minutes and...
And by the way, what is Vinyl Social Club?
Vinyl Social Club is a weekly event at this little dive bar called The Club in North Miami. And you go at like 9 o'clock, you sign up. It's like vinyl karaoke. And you play whatever it is you want for 20 minutes. You could play an audiobook if you'd like, anything.
You just go up there and just go.
Right. That's... So I went up there and it was a really transformative experience. Like just really... I didn't realize how exhilarating it would be. So when I found out about the first Girls Can Spin, which was during 3 Points last year, like I immediately jumped on it because I wanted to be more technically savvy and learn more.
What is it that you're learning in the course? Is it about the technical aspects of being a DJ, or is it about how to get out there and find jobs, find opportunities?
It definitely leans more towards the technical aspect, like how to use the software, how to use the controller. And then it just gives you time to play and experiment, how to transition from one song to the next, how to select, like how to, you know, make things cohesive and create a mood.
And so now that it's over, I mean, you know, everything that you've gained from that experience, what do you see yourself going with this? What do you see yourself taking that, all that knowledge?
I definitely would like to pursue DJing. I plan on starting a night downtown. I don't want to say where yet because it's not set in stone.
Okay.
But while I won't be DJing in the beginning, I think with a little more practice, like I would definitely like to, you know, start making a name for myself in Miami.
Is there a DJ that male or female, but specifically really actually female, that you look up to?
In Miami, I would say my favorites are female Hilltronics. She's a local DJ that is just a monster, and she plays vinyl as well. It's very, beautiful what she does. And then as far as males go, I love DJ Kumi, DJ Why Not. These guys are, I feel like, are just masterful and have like a wide range of selections to choose from.
So she's still spinning vinyl.
Yes, yes, yes. There are a few DJs in Miami.
Because everything now is totally digital.
Yes,
right?
Yes, yes. And this class was a digital class, but I definitely have an interest in both.
I see. And I'm going to show my age, because when I was trying to do this way back in the day, it was only vinyl.
Right.
So that's what we had. I guess I'm talking with Christina Hernandez and Monica Sorrell, two women from Girls Can Spin 2. That's an 8-week-long course that teaches women the art of DJing. And you can hear tomorrow a feature about the program from WLRN's Alex Gonzalez. Christina, how did this course come about? How was it created?
Well, I have a company, Art Cortex. I work with kids, mainly with private and public schools. And I was approached by 3 Points, actually. They were doing activations throughout the festival. So Helen is the founder of Found Power, and we were brought together. And then it just kind of worked out perfectly. We did one course. It was completely free for 90 minutes, and it was a huge success. And we came back with an 8-week course.
How would you describe your style? Because don't DJs have their own style, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, what's your style?
You know, I was born in the 80s, but I grew up in the 90s. So I'm very R&B, Aaliyah, Brandy, and then, you know, a little bit of future beat electronic tunes.
I think we have a little bit of a mix of that. Let's listen in.
Yeah, you may laugh, cause you did not do your math. Like one, two, three, the heart keeps turning. Oh, what a day, what a day.
Monica, I wanted to know, do you have a style you're developing right now? Do you have one?
I'm trying to develop it. I've also was raised in the 90s, so I definitely lean more towards like early 90s hip hop and R&B, but I love also the source of that music. So I love soul and disco. I love like samples.
I wanted to get a sense from both of you is really as women, how different is it the way you approach DJing? I'm wondering if there is a difference in how men do this and how women do this and how it pops up maybe in your style, in your sound. Is that, or is it, there's no difference?
I don't think there's a difference. Everyone has their own style. They grew up learning different techniques. DJing is an art that could be molded in many shapes.
I think it's definitely a androgynous art. So I think you can't really tell what gender is, you know, behind the mixer.
Do you have a DJ name, by the way? You guys have DJ names, right?
That was homework day one at our workshop. So
okay, so what? First of all, how do you come up with one? Do you come up with one, or somebody has to give you one?
No, you definitely come up with one. I came up with mine. Just I wanted always to mean something. So my DJ name is Vak Devi. And she is the spirit goddess of music and language.
And how do you spell that? It's
V-A-K-D-E-V-I, Vak Devi.
Oh, okay. Monica, are you still working on yours, or do you have one?
I just changed the first letters of my name. So I just go by Sonica Morel, which is like indicative of my, kind of a more freer personality, basically, like who I am when my inhibitions are lowered.
There you go. Is it, you know what? Give me a sense of the Miami scene when it comes to this industry. I mean, I love talking to musicians about the Miami scene, and is this a good place to try to come up as a musician? But what about as a DJ? How would you describe this compared to other cities? Is this where you would is this where you want to be to build yourself up as a DJ, or do you have to go somewhere else, Christina?
I think Miami thrives on nightlife. So DJing is a huge factor for a lot of places in Miami. I mean, Miami and LA, I would say, are the capitals of music as far as DJing and music production. So Miami is definitely a place to be right now.
Monica, where are you going next? You're graduating. What's next?
I'm going to focus on developing my new party, which, again, no details yet, but it will be a Tuesday night party, and you will be alerted as to what it is.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and just keep working on my craft and, you know, hope to get better and stronger.
Monica Sorrell, again, she's one of the students at this Girls Can Spin 2, the 8-week-long course that teaches women the art of DJing. It's run by one of the teachers there, is Christina Hernandez, who's also a DJ. And what's your DJ name again? Vok?
Vok Devi.
Devi, perfect. I wanted to get that right. Christina, yeah, thank you so much. Monica, I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.